This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, former Black Panthers celebrate the party's 50th anniversary in Oakland, California, where it all began. And a Haitian political activist says Hillary Clinton, not Donald Trump, is the greater evil of the 2016 U.S. presidential contest. But first, it's been 20 years since the start of the genocide in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a bloodbath that continues, provoked, according to United Nations reports, by U.S. allies in neighboring Rwanda and Uganda. The Friends of Congo noted the 20th anniversary of the genocide with an all-day teaching session in New York City. One of the speakers was Nita Evele of the Congo Global Action Coalition.
This war started as an invasion. In Africa, we have a say that said, when two elephants fight, the ants are the one who pay the price. In the DRC, it's not two elephants. It's a stampede of elephants. We're not just fighting against our own government, who's working against its own people. We're fighting against our neighboring countries, who figure out that they can make tons of money by helping, guess who, the big multinationals and the corporation and the big powers that are, you know them, the United States, the France, the Canada, all those big people. So we're fighting all those people, actually, to survive. And like many of you, I'm sure some of you are part of the, know about a lot of conspiracy theories or want to believe on some of the conspiracy theory. In DRC, the conspiracy theory coming to light, actually. And not only that, I'm sure some of you maybe have an idea of becoming a tyrant maybe later. Congo is one of the country and this history that shows you how you can be a tyrant and profit from. Why? Because when the invasion started in 96, actually, we all know that it came from, because there was genocide in Rwanda, and then the international community, of course, the UN has allowed the former army, Habyarimana, who was the Hutu president, to cross into the DRC with his army, with his guns and tanks and everything, and everybody else that fled the war in Rwanda came in DRC. Then the new government, because it was backed by the biggest country in this planet, the United States, decided to invade the DRC with a pretext to go fight the Hutu military that were staying in DRC. So they came in, and then they themselves perpetrated another genocide. But because the invading power, which is the Tutsi power in Rwanda, was backed by so big power, which is all those big powers, the story and the media already had a nuance. So we all know the genocide in Rwanda was only one-sided. That's only the Hutu, the Tutsi who died. The Hutu were the perpetrator of the genocide, but everybody else who died was Tutsi, and everybody else was the bad person was the Hutus. But when the war started in DRC and then the genocide of the Hutus happened, nobody changed that story. It remained, they had to kind of cover that story because nobody would believe the new lines that now the Tutsi who are supposed to be the saviors are doing exact same thing, but inside the DRC. But after that, the story is true. I'm not making this up. It's on the mapping reports. I think Kambale talked about the UN mapping reports, who expert in the UN went into DRC and wrote 600 pages on how the army of Paul Kagame has committed genocide in DRC. So, after that, everybody, I mean, when the invading power came in, Rwanda and Uganda, they were embedded with American soldiers. They had all those expert, multinational expert on geology, so were doing the mapping of the minerals. So when they invaded the Congo, they mapped all the minerals and where they were, and they had a map of all the riches that the Congo had in east of the part of the country. And it was clear now they had to get it out. And to get it out in the cheapest way, they didn't want to build new manufacturer of, let's say, cell phone in DRC. They didn't want to have a melting company in DRC. They just wanted the mineral, which was easy to for them to take out through other countries and bring it out. And that's where I'm sure the figure is going to take long. It's going to be expensive. And how they're going to fight a war that will take a long time and that will cost nothing. And the idea, I believe, it came out that they have to use terror. And terror in DRC came in the form of sexual violence. I'm going to explain why. At first, it was an invading power, invading army came in, and when they will invade a place, they will rape the women, just like we see on most of the wars. We saw that during the genocide in Rwanda, in Bosnia, in all those places. And then even at that time, the broken army of Mobutu, were they were not really an army, they were thugs. They were doing the same thing and everything. And then after that, it changed. It became the Hutu who fled in, the former army of Habyarimana who fled in, who were pretty much decimated by the invading power. Now they fled in the forest, and they wanted to prepare themselves and fight back. Like, they wanted to make sure they're going to create another army and fight back. And that's where you see, it's documented in the mapping report, they start abducting women in villages and taking them to the camp and like cattle and impregnating them to create an army. So the mass is a slave of women in that part was, the idea was, how can we create another army? Don't forget that most of the fighter that they picked during all those war, they were child soldiers. So they picked kids, 5, 4, 6 years old, all those kids, they picked them up and turned them into fighters. And those fighters, they were growing, knowing nothing but violence. So after that idea of recreating an army by impregnating Congolese women, at one point, the invading power decided to stop that idea. So they were going also to other village, preventing the women of DRC to be pregnant. So it was like a war on women's body. So one was trying to have babies, the other one was trying to prevent women from having babies. That means when they get to a village, sometimes it's not just rape women like you know it, they just destroy the women's genital parts. Like, they'll pull gasoline and put fire. They'll put a gun and just shoot, just to prevent that from happening. Like, all the girls, and then women, like Dr. Mukwege will explain to you that sometime in his tiny little hospital in Bukavu, she will have a victim of sexual violence. And without even asking, that lady will tell you exactly where she's coming from. You're coming from this part of the DRC where this group, rebel group, is. Or it's your Rasta or whatever, Motomboki. You can tell you because they were leaving a signature on women's body. When we say that the sexual violence in DRC went beyond and it's unprecedented, that's what we're talking about. Where people decide for the cheapest way to fight a war or fight your enemy is not by burying bullets or looking for them in that humongous forest. You just prevent them from having fighters, because most of the fighters there was child soldiers. And then after that, it became the fight of the minerals. Everybody wanted to make money. So the militaries, the invading power, and everybody else will use sexual violence to put terror on the villagers so they will leave the land and so that they can mine that part of the land. So women of DRC has fought for 20 years this war on their own body, the youngest. And then all those child soldiers. And also, like I said, in DRC, it's just, we're not just fighting our own government. We're not just fighting a tiny country, Rwanda. We're fighting all the power that support that system. And the multinational that support that system, when we'll talk about it and people will learn about what's happening, small pieces of reality when it comes out the media, then they'll try to help. Most of the peace accord that we signed made the things blur. So it just blur what's happening. You're not very sure. Is it an ethnic war? What is it happening? Is it a political war? I mean, it's just blur because, first of all, one of the panelists said, they decided all the accord, peace accord we had, they have decided all those militias, including those foreign fighters who came in DRC, become part of the army. So you wake up in the morning, yesterday, the same person who came and raped your family, kill your husband, kill your children, the next day he becomes the leading army in the Congolese army, and he's supposed to protect you. That's a joke, because that person sees you as an evidence. He's not going to protect you. He's going to make sure that he doesn't see you every day. He's going to threaten you so that you leave, or at least he's going to make sure that you never repeat that story. So that's what not only they didn't have justice, those women, they didn't see the world come to their rescue, but the world become their oppressor, because the same oppressor became today, including the president of DRC. He used to be a child soldier. He used to be in the army. He was part of the Tingitingi massacre in Kisangani. So today he's the president, and most of the people in army or in the parliament either were Maimai fighting, doing the same thing, raping and killing and all that, who they were part of the rebellion, all the rebellion that came in DRC all these 20 years. So I think we're going to continue this story. And what people do, what is the Congolese voice? We did try. We try as hard as we can to tell the story and keep to the truth, because most people wanted us to change the truth. They wanted us not to say, I remember when we started doing a little bit of activism in D.C., and then you come to conferences and say how this is not an ethnic war, this is an invasion, and people just kick you out because they believe you lying, or they don't want to listen to you because the reality they don't want to hear. Or when you say that the M23, the latest invasion in DRC, the M23, are not a rebellion of the minority Tutsi in DRC fighting against everybody else. That one was another story they were telling, because they say everybody else in DRC didn't like the Tutsi, that's why we're fighting them. There's 450 ethnic group in DRC. All of them cannot fight just one Tutsi power. How many of them? That was another story. So when we're trying to correct it, and most people wouldn't listen, and including the media, Paul, I'm sorry to tell you that, the media had already a langage, not going to say, to tell the story, and they didn't want to hear the other story. You can correct them as much as you want, that, hey, I'm sorry, but Congo war, it's not an ethnic war. But they'll still repeat there was an ethnic war, it's a war of power, this group and that group is fighting for land. Okay, yes, just like any neighbors, there's fight, of course. You fight for land or we fight for this man. When you put poverty and violence and trauma in that society, that violence can only go higher, because everybody's traumatized in the eastern part of Congo. Most of the people, like we're saying, there's 20 years of war. That's mean a child was born at the beginning of the war, today is an adult. All that child saw is violence, either by machetes or by violence somehow. And those kids are extremely traumatized. That's why in Panzi, for instance, Panzi Hospital, Dr. Mukwege had decided just healing the body of the women was not sufficient. That's not going to help the problem, because the more he was performing the surgery, the more women were coming back. So he came up with an idea of holistic way of serving the community, where Panzi is only one hospital in the tiny little village, capital in DRC. The violence happened all over eastern part of the Congo. So that little hospital has a holistic way of solving this issue. That means not only the women go through surgery and they are cared for, but also they have a psychiatrist that tend for their mental needs. And after that, because most of the people came from villages where everything was burned, the husband died, the kids were killed, or the kids were taken as child soldiers. So she has nothing to survive after that trauma. So the hospital tried to help them with skills, like maybe alphabetization or literacy skills, or skills on doing sewing or something, so that when she comes out of the hospital, she has something else to fight for. Or just sometimes they just give her a little bit of money to start maybe selling charcoal or whatever on the street so that she can survive. So other than that, they have La Maison Dorcas, that's what they call it. It's a place, it's like a sanctuary, because like we said, those women have been traumatized. Some of them can never leave the hospital, never, because they have so much wounds that as soon as they leave the hospital, they die of infection. There's women where all their genital parts has been destroyed completely, including the way to eliminate fecal matter. So they cannot eliminate fecal matters through the normal way of doing that. So they have tubes and bags and all this thing where somebody has to tend for them for the rest of their life. And that that number is between 40 and 60% of women in Panzi Hospital alone cannot leave that hospital. It's just sentencing them to death. But other than that, the Panzi Hospital also have a legal team that allow those women to complain if they can. Most time when they complain to a judge or anything, the perpetrator are pretty much arrested for one day and free the next. So it's very dangerous, because if you go and testify against somebody and then the next day is on the streets and with impunity, it might even kill you and nobody will say anything. So it's a very delicate job. Dr. Mukwege almost got killed 3 times. The people trying to murder him for what he does. Meanwhile, in DRC, the perpetrator of mass atrocity has been free, given high position in the government, given money. We just saw the last one is the guy Gedeon Kyungu in Katanga, because east of Congo goes from Oriental province all the way to Katanga. Kyungu, a murderer who's been arrested and condemned to death for what he does. This guy Gedeon was a Mai Mai in Katanga. He has killed, raped, eaten people, human flesh, and he was proud of it. He's walking around when he was a Mai Mai with somebody's head in his head and genitals hanging on his. And this guy has been pardoned a couple of days ago. He's free in Lubumbashi, and pretty much soon, him and his fighter will be part of the DRC army, because that's how they do. This is why they say we have to amnesty everybody who made mass atrocity and not amnesty the people who try to help the crisis that we have in DRC. I hope you understand the genesis of the story and how we got to now with the traumatized place where now babies and children are a victim of sexual violence. Thank you.
That was Nita Avele of the Congo Global Action Coalition. Hundreds of former members of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense gathered in Oakland, California to mark the organization's 50th anniversary. The event saw 4 days of intense discussion on the burning issues that confront today's Black liberation movement. The weekend also marked the 80th birthday of former Black Panther Party chairman and co-founder Bobby Seale, who was roasted and honored. Seale said, from the very beginning, he just wanted to put more Black people in elected office.
The idea of what we were dealing with was a continuing program that I started in 1965, before we even started the Black Panther Party. It was a time when we only had, and I did my own demographic research across the United States of America in 1965, when that book, Black Power, first came out. And I'm telling these young brothers, you ain't gonna get no power until you get some more political seats. And they talk about, what you mean? I say, them damn political seats up there. They did council seats, county supervisor seats, whatever, sir. You got to get some more of this. Well, I don't see how that's gonna work. I say, down south, I say, they got a lot of counties across the south, from the Carolinas to Mississippi and Arkansas. I said, in a lot of counties, you got the majority of Black folks. I said, in these counties, and sometimes they got, I says, if we could get those people registered to vote, they could elect the sheriff. They have a good progressive sheriff. And if the Ku Klux Klan acted up, the progressive sheriff can deputize 200, 300, 400 brothers and sisters in that and go over there and kick the Ku Klan's butt. I said, that's Black power. I said, in terms of defending yourself and stand up for your rights and not being murdered or killed. I said, so these political policies, right on down to the budgets and the monies and the funds and the taxes being allocated and not allocated for people of color. This is what's got. That was why I started Black Panther Party. I wanted a political organization. And that political organization that I wanted was going to be set up in chapter to chapter to chapter. That was my whole idea when we started. In that first year, we were only 50 members. What was in my head is ultimately I wanted to organize all across the country. In my demographic research in 1965, you know what I came up with? Asking myself, how many Black politicians are duly elected? At that time, I came up with 50. was only 50 black politicians elected throughout the whole of the United States of America. Started from local city council to a full-time city council, county supervisors, supervisors, sheriffs, etc. And when you added it all up, how many political seats could you be elected to in the whole of the United States of America? You know what I came up with? 500,000 political seats you could be elected to throughout the whole of the United States of America. And we had but 50 black folks checking around, very few Chicano Mexican Americans, very few. And women wasn't even in the mix. Damn. That's why I started the Black Panther Party, a political party. Yeah, we named the Black Panther Party for self-defense to start off with. And we went out there to patrol the police as a tactic to capture the imagination of the people. And I would tell Huey, and we're going to capture the imagination of the people, and I said, I'm going to organize a political electoral unit, and we're going to take over some of these damn seats. And that was what it was about. I told Huey, you got to research this stuff about patrolling these police. That's a tactic. Yeah, we can capture the imagination of people. He did the research, etc. He was in law school 2 years, what have you, at that time, etc. And we got out there with our guns, legal, etc. I made sure it was legal guns, everything. And the cop says, you have no right to observe me. And Huey says, no, California State Supreme Court ruling states that every citizen has a right to stand and observe a police officer carrying out their duty as long as they stand a reasonable distance away. A reasonable distance, that particular rule. I'm standing here, and I will observe you whether you like it or not. And some sister on the sidewalk says, well, go ahead on and tell it, brother. And the cop says, is that gun loaded? He would say, if I know it's loaded, it's good enough. Well, I have a right. He would say, you have no right whatsoever. Stand back, United States Supreme Court, so-and-so. Therefore, you cannot remove my property from it without due process of law. Step back. You cannot touch my weapon. The tall black brother over here come out. He said, man, what kind of Negroes is he? It had never been done before. Throughout all that research, understanding my African-American history. The 116,000 to 38,000 died and 168,000 was enlisted into the Civil War following the Emancipation Proclamation. When I read and understood that history, and we actually had some early black congressmen in the Reconstruction period, and looking at that, that was what got me. You know, so the Black Panther Party evolved out of that. As Bertrand Morrell was up here talking about, yeah, we put black history into the curriculum of American College, and I organized programs in the community in 1964, way before the party was started. So I quit that job at Kaiser Aerospace and Electronics just because I wanted to work in the grassroots community. It was a great job, fantastic. Worked 3.5 years there, you know, in working in the engineering department. My point is, I wanted to do something. I listened to a lot of theory and stuff, but I like to make things real. So when I put that program together and put reference programs together, it was all connected with voter registration also, because ultimately that is what we're going to go after. They killed Dr. Martin Luther King. I only had 400 members up and down the West Coast. From the day they killed Dr. Martin Luther King to the day Nixon got elected, I had 400 members of the Black Panther Party, and then 7 months later Nixon got elected, I got 5,000 members. Young brothers and sisters and people all across this country, when they killed Dr. Martin Luther King, flooded into our organization. And you had to organize them. Not here just to carry a gun. You're here to do some grassroots political organizing. You know, and I taught them dialectics. I don't want to know even coming you with this, oh, the white man's a devil. It's totally unscientific. From an anthropological standpoint, I ain't got no time for that. Go over there and talk. Take your metaphor. Go over to the brothers over there in the Nation of Islam. Thank you. I said, well, my organization, we gonna organize a political electoral machine. And so my point is, putting the party together, that was my, well, and it's all. Now, you know, we have received international notoriety after I led that armed delegation to the California State Legislature against the Mulford Act. The Mulford Act was trying to stop us legally carrying guns and observing the police, but we also carried law books. I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, it continues, and I'm trying to talk to a lot of young brothers and sisters and people from the Black Lives Movement and other people.
to understand that, yes, you got a great movie, you have to continue to serve, but you're going to have to pull yourself together. And whether you're Black Lives Movement or not, you support the framework or not. You need to get some little committees in your little cities, the community areas and stuff, to have some committee leadership. Same kind of committee leadership I attempted to structure each and every chapter and branch. You know, we had the Central Committee was the national headquarters, and the state chapter had the state chapter Central Committee, and the branches had a branch committee. What I mean is informed committees, where you research, where you know, where you got the information, et cetera. You do organizing, and you know your political structure and what was going on. You know your councilmatic district. You know your state assembly district and who the politicians are, et cetera. Check their paper trail out, check their voting trail out, see if they're progressive, middle of the road, whatever, hardcore right wing or what. This is the kind of stuff you got to know. We need a broad, profound, progressive movement in this country. There are some 90 Democrats and others who will vote basically for progressive processes, you know what I mean? In the House of Representatives, you know what I mean? From low-level progressive to top-level progressive vote. Top-level progressive vote, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, over here. Top one. Along with Maxine Waters and the rest of them. You know, to me, from what I was after, and to see Barbara Lee and Dellums and everybody, I mean, I knew Dellums before we patrolled the police. He said, man, maybe I need to join you guys. I said, I thought you was going to run for city council. In Berkeley, he says, yeah. I said, you run for city council, so what? I said, well, my objective is to get more Black politicians. And that's what happened. I mean,
we live in an overdeveloped, high-tech, fast-paced, computerized, scientific, technological, social order. We are not even living in the 60s anymore. You understand that? I mean, it's like we said, all we had was the ADJ machine. And when they came out with an electric stencil burner, I thought that was advancement. You know what I mean? And I worked for the government. I worked for the city car. I was in every framework. I helped put nonprofit entity programs together back in those days, you know, et cetera, boom, boom, boom. That's what it was about. And I was very dedicated to that, you know. I'm a little architect, you know what I mean, and stuff like this here. So you can have all the plans you want and all the theories you want that relates to the plans, et cetera. But you have to go out and do something real and do real organizing. And I know you have to have jobs, et cetera, and you definitely, I want you to have jobs. And I'm hoping like hell this damn election coming up here now is a landslide. It's a landslide because I want to see that infrastructure bill turn into an infrastructure climate change balance ecology bill. And we talk about Apple and 1.5 million jobs. We talk about the possibility of involving 5 million jobs. That's the kind of bill I want to see. That need to be changed in a progressive direction. That's the damn thing that's got to be done. And I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do my little program here, Environmental Renovation Youth Jobs Project. I mean, I've run these programs all over the country, before the Black Panther Party, through the Black Panther Party, and after the Black Panther. It was trying to get brothers and sisters on those grassroots connections, young generations coming up behind me. So I'm still going to do this. And yeah, I'm 80 years old. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I go to the gym every day. I've been going to the gym every day since I was 47 years old. Yeah. I stopped all that drinking. But my point is, I want to use all the rest of parts of my life to really try to put something together that makes human sense. And I'm going to make my film, too. You see half these guys in here. It's my crew. It's my company that those films are. And I'm saying that's all connected with a present coming up documentary and other things like this here. So you go to my site, you want to order books, what have you, et cetera. You want to get me to speak somewhere, et cetera. All you're doing is helping me put together these programs and helping me gather this information to help brothers and sisters understand that our continuing human liberation struggle rests upon them. We live in an overdeveloped, high-tech, fast-paced, computerized, scientific, technological, social order. Right on, power to the people.
Former Black Panther Party Chairman Bobby Seale. If you are from Haiti, Bill and Hillary Clinton may look like the greater evils of the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
Haitian community political activist Daoud André led a protest against New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, whose office has been investigating Donald Trump's charitable organization. André says Schneiderman is showing his political bias by leaving Bill and Hillary Clinton's multi-billion dollar global fundraising empire untouched.
As people from Haiti and as people who've been denouncing fraud and corruption at the Clinton Foundation for 2 years now, we've been holding demonstrations everywhere that's connected to the Clintons, and it's like they never heard us. So we went there to tell Schneiderman, to tell the New York State that this is an obvious double standard, and it shows the bias that's going on over here. We understand that the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton is their candidate, and the administration here in New York is solidly behind Clinton, and Schneiderman himself, we understand, not only he's a member of the Leadership Council for the Clinton campaign for New York State, but he's also personally donated the maximum amount allowed, I think it's $2,700. But if you are Attorney General for the state of New York and you want to carry on some pretense of justice, of impartiality, he, on his website, he has something saying that justice will be blind, that, you know, everyone will be treated the same. Well, this gives a lie to this statement by him choosing to prosecute Trump and ignore the crimes, the theft of billions. And Trump's foundation, this is a couple million dollars that we're talking about. But the Clinton Foundation, this is a matter of billions of dollars.
So for partisan political reasons, here we have the Attorney General of the state of New York aiding and abetting a person who you accuse of being a mega criminal in Haiti, but prosecuting someone else for stealing far lesser amounts.
You know? So basically that was the point. We had a very vocal group. We gave out hundreds of flyers. We were joined by some allies, Brother Ralph Poynter, Sister Betty from the New Abolitionist Movement. We had Brother Kumar Arvind, who's a Hindi-American activist. We had Mr. Charles Ortel. He came. He's a writer, a financial analyst who was involved in taking down the General Electric, denouncing the frauds at AIG. And for the past 2 years, Mr. Ortel has been investigating the Clinton Foundation. And basically, he's called it the largest criminal fraud organization, nonprofit that's out there right now. And so, but the Attorney General of New York, Justice Department for the United States, the State Department, the White House, they are protecting Hillary Clinton, and we've always said this. The only reason that Hillary Clinton is not in jail, the only reason that the Clinton Foundation is not shut down, it is precisely because they are being protected by at the highest levels of the U.S. government.
If Hillary Clinton wins in November, it'll be her and Bill's second time in the White House in this country. But during the interim period, they reign supreme in another country, in Haiti.
Yes. And what we say, it's like Barack Obama gave Haiti to the Clintons as a gift. When Hillary Clinton, it was Secretary of State for the United States. Basically, the United States runs everything in Haiti. They claim to be the largest monetary donor. The United States ambassador announces when elections are happening or not happening. And it's important to understand that all USAID funds that go to foreign countries, Haiti in this case, are controlled by the Secretary of State. In addition to that, you had Ban Ki-moon at the United Nations in 2009, March of 2009. He names Bill Clinton as his special envoy to Haiti. And it's very ironic, the moment that this had happened, Haiti had just suffered a succession of four major storms and hurricanes. And the idea was that Bill Clinton was going to raise money to, this is when he came with this line of building Haiti back better. And what he specifically said was that Haiti would be in a better position to withstand natural disasters. And a lot of money did come into this office as the special envoy. We don't know what happened to these millions. We know the earthquake happens less than a year later. Hillary Clinton personally maneuvered to have Bill Clinton named the head of the interim Haiti Reconstruction Recovery Commission, is what they called it. And this is against the wishes of the Haitian government at the time and against the wishes of the Caribbean community, who had put forward P.J. Patterson, former Prime Minister of Jamaica, to hold that position. In any event, Hillary Clinton had the full weight of the U.S. government and succeeded in having Bill Clinton in this position. And as the responsible person for this recovery commission, all monies that were raised by foreign governments for the earthquake, they had the responsibility for. Bill Clinton had the responsibility for. And some people are saying, why do we say that he's the one who stole this money? This is the famous, infamous $6 billion we're always talking about. We talk about it because a few months after he's in this position, this commission, which had at least six or seven Haitian representatives on it, they had all signed this document saying that they are there as a rubber stamp body, and Bill Clinton basically hands them these no-bid contracts that were given to cronies of the Clinton Foundation, people who then gave high-priced speeches to Clinton, paid speeches to Clinton, who then kicked back money to the Clinton Foundation. But it doesn't stop there. Barack Obama puts him at the head of the Clinton-Bush Fund, along with the clown George Bush, the son. And George Bush really, you know, didn't, it's not something it seems he really cared for. But Bill Clinton, again, was the one in charge of this money. So we're saying, look at all of this money. And we didn't talk about the Clinton Foundation, that countries, corrupt corporations around the world that probably don't even know where Haiti is, the government of Algeria, Saudi Arabia. Imagine that after the earthquake, instead of giving money to the CIRH or to the Haitian government, they are giving money to the Clinton Foundation to help Haiti. So it is all a farce, a big joke, and were it not for the millions of victims of this earthquake, people who right now, as we are talking 6 years later, are still living under tents and who were victims of this last storm, I mean, it would be really funny, a real joke that's played on our people. So this is what we have been saying, and this is why we're saying the American people should not accept this Schneiderman from Obama. You know, we understand that they want to do everything to get Hillary in so they can continue their corruption, which obviously they are a part of. But we're saying we in the Haitian community who happen to be here in the U.S., we do have an obligation to go and to denounce it and let the world know that this is absolutely unacceptable. We say, and we have always said to our people, with regard to this U.S. election, whatever happens to be able to stop Hillary Clinton, we will support that. We said if it's a dog running against Hillary Clinton, you have to vote for this dog because of the harm that this family has caused our people. When it was Bernie Sanders, we said fine, you know, because we had been protesting, telling the Democratic Party, find someone else. Find someone else. But of course, we know the collusion. We know that she's the one they wanted there. So we had told people, yeah, if you're going to vote for a Democrat, vote for Bernie Sanders. Right now, we are in a position where we are. We have taken the responsibility to tell our people, if Donald Trump, a racist Donald Trump, is the one who can stop Hillary Clinton from becoming the next president of the U.S., yeah, vote for Donald Trump. And I have to tell you, Glenn, it's always been our sisters and brothers, black people here, who have been most aggressive against us when we are protesting against the Clintons. You would think that the Clintons have been so good to black people. And we tell them about the crime bill. We tell them about all of these things, the prisons, the millions of our people that they've put in jail. And about Hillary, you know, supporting Barry Goldwater, and that it hasn't changed because look what she did just last month with Colin Powell, saying the black man made me do it, told me to do it. And we're like, how different is that from Susan Smith drowning her children in a car and then saying that, you know, it was a black man who took my car and then dumped my kids in this water. So we're saying Clinton is no less of a racist than Donald Trump. And as to the harm that this family has actually done and the garbage that spews from the mouth of Trump, we say, yeah, hey, to stop Hillary Clinton, definitely vote for Trump.
So Hillary Clinton and her husband are certainly not lesser evils either here or in Haiti.
Definitely not. The lesser evil in this case for the meek who choose the option of lesser evil happens to be Donald Trump. And we read a very good piece from Pam Bazooka News last week where they asked the same question, Trump or Clinton, who is better for Africa? And after much analysis, they like, yeah, we wouldn't choose either of them, but between the two, Africa will be much better off with a Donald Trump presidency. Because we're saying that of these two devils, one of them has already eaten our children. So we have to make a choice. And like I said, I have always said we would love to support Jill Stein and Brother Ajamu. We would love to support socialist candidates or other candidates that are obviously much better. Monica Moorhead, that was someone who's been at our protests since the 80s, supporting the Haitian people in our struggle. But none of these candidates will be able to stop Hillary Clinton from becoming president. So what we're saying, we ask people, drop your registration with the Democratic Party. We don't have many of our people who are registered as Republicans. Register as a Green. Register as an independent. But definitely in November 8, drop a vote for Donald Trump.
That was Haitian community activist Daoud André. The medical crisis facing the nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and thousands of other Pennsylvania prison inmates with untreated hepatitis C was the subject of a production at the National Black Theater in New York's Harlem. The show was titled Survival Crimes. Carl Frazier was one of the organizers of the play, put together by members of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home and the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee.
Essentially, we're looking at the Mumia Abu-Jamal health crisis and the responses in the courts to Mumia Abu-Jamal's health, and more specifically around Hep C, which is plaguing many imprisoned and non-imprisoned individuals across the U.S., as well as the issues around the Bronx 120, who were raided by several different state agencies back in April, 120 individuals from the Williamsbridge section of the Bronx taken in under so-called RICO conspiracy charges in what they're terming the largest gang takedown in New York City history. So the event Survival Crimes, which took place up at the National Black Theater, was our attempt to shed light on these two major issues and to draw out the connectivity between these issues, and just to really bring out the fact that we're dealing with the criminalization of people's lives and in a very targeted way.
And of course, one of the villains of the sketch is the judge in Mumia Abu-Jamal's appeal that he, and not only he, but thousands of others who have hepatitis C untreated in the Pennsylvania prison system be treated by the state. The judge puts on a performance, and at the end of the play, decides that Mumia's health is in fact in danger, but will not get redress in that suit.
Exactly. And I appreciate that you mentioned the theatrical element in the courts themselves. That was definitely one of the aspects that we were looking to, in trying to put this event together, that we were really looking to bring to light. Not only the theatrics of a Judge Mariani in trying to, although commiserating with those who are suffering from hepatitis C and acknowledging the unconstitutional nature of the policy that the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections has in place, still making sure to maneuver politically in such a way that Mumia Abu-Jamal is still not receiving the treatment that he and all of those imprisoned in Pennsylvania and across the country deserve. And what's more, on the theatrical end, the entire spectacle of these law enforcement so-called agents swooping in, you know, with helicopters to this neighborhood and using these shock and awe tactics. So just looking to acknowledge the theatrics of the state and how through those histrionics, state agents attempt to essentially scare us into a state of confusion and disallow us from seeing what they're doing clearly.
Yes, and in the real world, this raid, this roundup in the Bronx was even larger than one a couple of years ago in Harlem, a pre-dawn roundup that took in about 100 young women and men.
Right, exactly. That took place, as you mentioned, a few years ago now, up in the Grant houses. And as we've been finding out more and more, just in getting in touch with people who have been affected by similar tactics, this tactic of the so-called gang raid seems to be building in the city. And we've heard statements to the effect that there would be more of these raids. And this is shown to be true more recently in the Astoria area of Queens. We've heard about raids taking place. So it seems to be a tactic that is being developed and attempts are being made to use it more and more against our communities. But yes, this particular raid of 120 individuals is, to our knowledge, the largest of them in the city's history.
This all takes place under the reign of Bill de Blasio, the great white liberal hope in New York City.
Precisely. Seem to recall a lot of rhetoric around, you know, the tale of two cities coming from that camp during election time. And a lot of talk went toward the fact that under such an administration, I guess those two cities would be bridged somehow, or there would be an alleviation of the inequalities that we're witnessing here in New York City. But as we can see with these kinds of raids, clearly we're still dealing with it, these two cities that are mentioned. It would be unimaginable that this kind of an attack on a neighborhood would occur in some of our more wealthy New York City neighborhoods, some of our neighborhoods that are not majority black and brown populated.
And this presentation at the National Black Theater was called Survival Crimes. Why'd you call it that? And why are you using a political sketch forum as your vehicle?
Well, survival crimes, we hear terms like crimes of survival. And, you know, it seems like an appropriate term in a lot of instances, just given the class structure of the United States, just given the highly racialized nature of what is referred to as law enforcement in this country and the longstanding history around race criminalization, which goes as far back as you want to look in terms of the United States. So on the one hand, we have just the fact that in many instances, for many groups in the United States, survival does entail an element that is deemed criminal with respect to the state. Now, how that criminality or how law enforcement is actually allocated in practice is often at odds with what the so-called laws that are on the books. But even outside of that, we wanted to make sure that the question of just survival itself being criminalized was brought out. The fact that people living in a certain area or people being of a certain racial background or ethnic background in many ways has been criminalized and for a long time has been criminalized in this country. And we also want to acknowledge that political prisoners like our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, they are targeted. Political individuals are targeted. Mumia Abu-Jamal, we know, is targeted and is in many ways being further penalized, or the state is attempting to further punish him for having survived the targeting that they directed toward him. And so really just trying to bring together those commonalities of, we can talk about crimes of survival and what should be, you know, defined as a crime versus what shouldn't. But at the same time, it's really critical that it's clear to people that in many ways, just people's very being is criminalized under these conditions.
As part of that presentation at the National Black Theater, you had Mumia's lawyer, Bob Boyle, Niles Fort, who's an activist and a minister, the legendary organizer and activist, Pam Africa of the MOVE organization. But at the top of the billing, you have Immortal Technique, the hip-hop lyrical artist.
That's right. Immortal Technique graced the stage for us, as did the other individuals that you mentioned. Immortal Technique, as usual, spoke impassionately and very accurately about the issues that we were looking to raise through the survival crimes event and by using a comic sketch to humanize some of the elements that attempts are being made to dehumanize of some of these stories or some of the people who are affected by acts like these raids, people who are affected by just deliberately indifferent correctional entities or a complete lack of respect for the humanity of individuals who are imprisoned and the value of their lives. So, yes, the panel discussion was very much worthwhile and touched on these issues in depth. And again, it just further helped us all to see the connections between them, between these at times seemingly disparate issues.
And do you plan to take this comedic approach to politics on the road?
Well, that's kind of the question that's up in the air right now. So much effort and so many different skill sets, you know, went into getting the sketch actually to be done. And so now that it is done and we actually were able to perform it, yeah, questions are arising as to where to go from here with it, you know, whether we should add something to this one or go in a different direction, but with similar premise. The sense that I'm getting from people is that there is interest in keeping this going. So yes, if there are spots on the road for survival crimes or a similar sketch to be performed, it seems that we have the personnel to do so.
Well, certainly there is an audience out there, a directly impacted audience, everywhere in Black and Brown America.
That's exactly right. So ideally, we can keep with the longstanding tradition that exists with respect to bringing art, bringing theater directly to those who are impacted, direct actions through, in this case, comedic sketches, but just bringing art directly to those who are, as you say, most impacted by the themes addressed in that art. I mean, that kind of intervention is often a welcome one and one that I feel that we welcome taking up if people will have us.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.